I'd like to introduce our panelists, but before I do that, I wanted to check. I hate to do this before we have a conversation, but there's a Wi-Fi for the conference, and it is sponsored by LightSquare, and you'll find it at AT&T meeting or Wakeport meeting. I happen to find it at Wakeport meeting. I didn't have to use a password, but it says LightSquare, the sponsor, is the password as well. Don't do it for like an hour, you know. We like to engage people in our conversation, if you don't mind. I'd like to introduce our panelists, probably in the order that they're going to speak. And that will be on the far right here, Mike Westnow. Mike is from, it's all up here, isn't it? I'm having a hard time with the glasses. These cheaters don't quite make the screen, and they don't make this here. But we'll do very well, I'm sure. Everyone in the room, I'm guessing, is a PEG operator of some sort, right? I want to get a feel for things a little bit. I was sort of curious. Let's have a little show of hands. This is like the exercise portion. Who does community access, PEG access? Okay, who does government? Oh, really? Oh, okay. And who does education? We got a good audience. We're in good shape. So, Michael's going to talk first, mostly because it doesn't flow perfectly, but he has a great discussion about money. And since revenue is everything, we thought maybe we'd start with him. Michael, why don't you come up, and then afterwards, Cece will talk about her facilities in Portland, and Bob will talk about some of the training and some of the school things they have going in D.C. Okay?
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
How is everybody?
Good.
Left their energy in the room. I'm Mike Wassenaar. I'm the executive director of St. Paul Neighborhood Network. We're a 501c3 public access and educational access operator, but I think more importantly, we're defining ourselves really as a community media center in the Twin Cities. I've been with the organization for 11 years this year, and I wanted to just kind of give you some perspectives in terms of maximizing revenue as you're concentrating on your operations. I realize that not everybody in the room has the same type of operation, even though you all raised your hands at the same time for certain types of things, primarily because you're all working in different communities with different types of resources that are available, different needs, and specifically also, in some cases, different histories in terms of how you fund certain types of community-based services. That's, I think, a reflection of what we see in St. Paul as part of our success story over the course of the last decade. But I think it's something to keep be mindful of as you're thinking about growing programs, growing revenue streams, and really growing responsive programs to your community needs at a time that you're really trying to maximize your program dollars. So let's see if we can kind of go forward. Can you guys see this at all?
No.
Blurry.
Can you use the mic too much?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Is that better?
No.
Is that better? No? Oh, actually, probably for the...
The mic's not on.
The mic's not on.
I guess I was just showing.
Yeah. Pat on the stand.
Boy, with pipes like that, you need to hear it.
Can everyone hear me in the back of the room?
Nope, there's our man too.
Okay.
It's hard to believe he has his working papers, isn't it?
Yeah.
He makes me feel like a grandfather.
Right. Technology people never figure out technology at the
end. What's that?
So the operative question that Mike posed as we were considering this panel is should you be finding ways to maximize other revenue streams for your facilities? And should you be finding ways to be creative with the way you're using your facilities to be able to meet community needs? And I think my answer is yes, but it's complicated. Okay, it's complicated by a whole host of factors, and I could talk specifically about.
Grab the handheld, please.
Should we do the handheld?
Yeah. That way we've got better.
Better.
Switch on the monitor.
You know, I worked in radio for 20 years. Should have been working in comedy. All right.
Is that better?
Yes.
So
give me the morning drive quick.
Okay, so the I-9 is anyway, so we're just gonna go forward with this. So, you know, the question really is, you know, should we be doing things like renting our facilities, seeking grants to provide programming, provide services to nonprofits? I mean, those are the operative questions that Mike presented at the beginning of this. My answer is yes to diversifying your revenue. Specifically, I point this out to people because I liken my life as the executive director of a nonprofit to being like a dinosaur. And I mean that in the best sense, because dinosaurs were highly adapted, highly successful organisms that could not deal with environmental change. Correct?
Yes.
So, as I talk to my staff and we talk about program diversification, revenue diversification, I tell my staff that I want to be the furry mammal that survives the asteroid strike. I do not want to be the top-heavy dinosaur that cannot adapt and change when environmental conditions change. And really, this is sort of a theory of like how you're running your nonprofit. For me, the question ends up being, how does my nonprofit meet my community's needs so that we can be an essential organization for different groups within the community, but also for our political leadership as well. Okay, so I'm constantly asking my staff to be thinking about how we can be indispensable. And I would suggest that should be the first thing that you're thinking about as you're thinking about diversifying revenue. So the short answer is yes to diversifying revenue. The long answer is it's complicated. Three things to be thinking about. You think about revenue strategies as you're trying to grow revenue for any organization. Revenue strategies take time. It's a lot like dating and building a relationship with a loved one. I mean, yes, lightning may strike. You may get something a bolt out of the blue, and suddenly someone hands you $1 million and just falls out of the sky into your lap. It does not work that way. Relationships take time. Revenue strategies take time. Revenue strategies also should be mission related. Philosophically, you've got to think, I think, as any nonprofit, any healthy nonprofit, or any service-based organization, you have to be consistently thinking about the mission. And I think there's a fallacy very often, not just in our field, but within the nonprofit community at large, that mission doesn't equal money. The way I look at things, money helps you actually make sure that your mission lives. And you should be thinking about that as well, I think, if you're thinking about revenue strategies. You should not be chasing dollars for the sake of dollars. That is a sign of someone who's panicking and just, you know, trying to find ways to meet the bills that they have to pay for things that they committed to yesterday. So I would strongly suggest, as you're thinking about any type of revenue strategy, it has to be mission related. If it's not mission related, either your mission, and you think it actually is a legitimate thing to do, your mission may need to change to reflect community need, environmental need. But certainly, you shouldn't be just trying to chasing dollars for the sake of chasing dollars. Very often I hear where PEG facilities are thinking about, you know, renting out their equipment because they have excess capacity and renting it out at commercial rates. And I would strongly suggest thinking through what exactly that means, because my guess would be that if no one's using the facility because you've got excess capacity, your odds of being successful renting out your equipment at a commercial level probably are low. And we can kind of talk about that philosophically. The third thing then is to think that revenue strategies demand resources. It's a mistake to think that you can just sort of get money magically. You have to be devoting time to it primarily, staffing. In some cases, you have to bring in expertise from the outside to be able to grow revenue. But it demands resources. Okay, so it's a fallacy to think that you can just simply write grants magically, and that'll somehow save your organization when you're in need of revenue. It doesn't happen that way. So our example at SPNN, I don't know if you can see this pretty well, I'm really sorry about this. In 2000, when I came on board, our total revenue was $850,000 for our organization. This last year, it was $2.3 million. Primarily, we did that through program growth. Okay, so we aren't doing the same things in 2010 that we were doing in 2000. We were developing programs that were meeting community need, like youth services, youth media services that we provide, nonprofit partnerships that we provide, so that nonprofits have the ability to educate people in the community through video, as well as tell their story about what they do, as well as help us with our community-based mission for our program channel. And then the single largest program spurt that we've seen really has been the last 7 years as we've hosted an AmeriCorps program, which basically does digital literacy education with nonprofits, libraries, and youth centers throughout the Twin Cities. That alone is a program that caused our organization to grow by about $700,000 a year. We got to that place, though, because we were thinking about how to meet community need. And we were open to the idea of partnerships, specifically with nonprofits, to be able to meet our mission. Our core programs are our Access Department. Looks and sounds and feels an awful lot like what you see in the Access Centers all throughout the country. So it's not that exotic. Our program channels, not that exotic. You have these types of resources as well that in terms of your program services that you're providing your community. Our youth programs, which really have tripled in size over the course of the last 10 years, where we're doing after-school and now in-school work with high school and middle schoolers in St. Paul, specifically to help them use media to be able to really document the lives of the community around them. So it's a youth-based after-school programming. And then our digital literacy education, our AmeriCorps program, which actually we're thinking about expanding to other communities across the country. So if you're interested in finding out more about AmeriCorps generally, come see me, or if you're interested in perhaps hosting one of our AmeriCorps members, I'd love to talk with you sometime during the course of the next couple of days. We're actually thinking about trying to expand the project nationally so that we can be using that digital literacy model for other community media centers. Our core funding streams that we've developed, local, state, federal government grants. So we've had to develop skills specifically to be able to manage grants and to work with program staff. So I suggest you have to think through exactly what you're taking on if you're going to be potentially going down that road. Private grant making, earned income, primarily through our nonprofit partnership program that where we produce a nonprofit video in partnership with about 120 organizations a year. The reason we developed that program initially was not for revenue purposes. It was to get higher quality material on our channels. So we began partnership really to be developing more educational material that could be reaching viewers, and also to be getting contracting resources in the door to be able to actually increase the technical quality of our productions. So that was really the motivator behind the partnership that we were working with for that. That currently generates about $200,000 a year just in earned income. In-kind donations that we receive, and then memberships for our Access programming particularly. The thing I would say with the funding streams that you should be thinking about as you're thinking about trying to grow revenue to be able to meet challenges is that even though these are all different types of buckets, you may find that things happen that you can't quite predict. So for example, we've been doing private granting for our AmeriCorps program with a local foundation, a corporate foundation, for about 6 years. They've been giving us small amounts of money, about $10,000 a year. They loved our program. They recently went out of business. And we thought, well, gee, we're going to lose this partner that we'd had this great relationship with for a long period of time. The head of the corporate foundation came to an annual event that we held at SPNN. He not only loved one program, he fell in love with the entire organization by meeting staff, meeting constituents, meeting young people, part of our organization. And I got an unsolicited phone call from him about a year ago this time. He said, Mike, what would you do with $750,000? Could you write a paragraph for me? So I wrote him a paragraph, and he liked that. He said, okay, well, give me a page. And I gave him a page. And in early December, the wire transfer occurred as he dissolved the corporate foundation. So we got an unsolicited $750,000 grant. Now, I didn't knock on someone's door saying, I need money to be able to make that happen. I delivered programs on a consistent basis. I tried to engage people to make sure that they were partners with us in creating those programs. And then we gave people an opportunity to continue the relationship, not maybe with that program, but maybe with something else that they can do. So I would suggest to you that really you need to think about cultivating resources in your community. Let's see if I ordered that page down. So the overall effect of this is really to lessen our overall reliance on our cable grant. In 2000, we had 85% of our revenue coming from our cable grant. This year, it's at about 40%. So if there's ups or downs in terms of that cable granting resource, it's not going to be an asteroid strike with my organization. Okay? Let me say that again. It doesn't mean that my programs won't change if there's an environmental change with that cable grant. And I say this to all my staff, because we're not guaranteed things in life. And things can change over time. But we have to be developing resources to be able to meet changing needs within our community. So if something happens with that cable grant, my organization doesn't go poof. Right? That's been the strategy all along. Reduction of the grant resources from the cable grant would probably mean reduction of cable grant related programs. Meaning, if I've got highly subsidized services from the cable grant, they probably change radically if that grant is reduced or disappears. Just like any other program in this world. And I think that's the message I want to really send to everybody here. As we think about limited resources and competition for dollars, you cannot get something for nothing in this world. And I think there's a message that really needs to be hammered away for people, especially in the policy making. They constantly say things, oh, you can trim fat, oh, you can reduce excess costs, you can do this, you can do that. Sure, you can do that. But if you actually cut away key parts of services, you will not be able to actually do things in the world. And so, and this kind of gets to this question of, can we, if there's reductions, can you do things on the cheap? Sure you can. It's just the organization will be radically different. The types of services you can provide will be radically different. And you have to be prepared for that. So some of our programs are heavily dependent on the cable grant. Others are independent of the grant. In its entirety. Our AmeriCorps program actually nets positive back to the organization about $30,000 a year. And again, those resource types that we use, grants, primarily program and capacity related, meaning ways in which we can actually build muscles for our organization or deliver services to people in the community. Earned income resources, primarily partnership revenue that we get from nonprofits that we do production work with. Those are program related costs, right? And then donations. That's actually the fastest growing portion of our revenue streams right now. We're actually seeing 200 to 300% growth in terms of donations every year. It's not the largest percentage of our revenue, but it's the fastest growing, and it's the most independent revenue that we have. That's something to be thinking about as you're diversifying revenue. Is that if you're getting a program-related grant or a program-related investment, you actually have to commit to doing that program, and it ties down resources. You may think that it's actually providing you freedom. It's actually forcing you to do things. Someone giving you a donation provides you independence. They may love you, to get back to the relationship, the dating stuff I was talking about earlier, they may love you for who you are and what you do, but typically if they give you something that's unrestricted, it literally means that you can be doing it for anything that's mission-related. And that's like gold within the nonprofit world. And the other thing to think about, too, as you're kind of thinking about program revenue growth strategies, and we talk about this a little bit more, is that they've been both constant. We've seen actually constant growth, but we've also seen punctuated growth that you can't predict. Meaning, I can predict that there's going to be a certain level of program grants that we can get in the community every year. Unsolicited gifts of $750,000, you can't predict. Okay? Same thing happens then with other types of partnerships that will come your way if you're open to getting partnerships with other organizations. You cannot necessarily predict where those will occur or how they will occur. So as you look at sort of the stream of revenues for us, it's been constantly growing up, but you know, you see these spikes every once in a while. Get used to that idea, frankly, that you are doing sort of constant pressure to gain revenue as you're trying to grow programs, but then be open to things that happen. So that's kind of some examples in a nutshell. I can talk more specifically about this. I know we're kind of covering a lot of ground here, and hopefully the technology will work better as we're moving along. So.
Thanks, Mike. That's great. Mike, I'm going to take a guess here and say that your spend rate on that $750 is not going to be 1 year.
That is correct.
Just wanted to make sure of that. Our next speaker coming up is Cece Ewing-Noel from who went to Natura in Portland? I went. It was a lot of fun. Okay, good. So you may have visited her facilities, but I understand there's been quite a few improvements, and she's here to chat about them now.
Okay, thanks. Great. Again, I'm one of those people who has to constantly say my name a number of times before people get it and don't call me C or CC or whatever. So thank you, Mike, for that. That was really good.
I learned that lesson over the first three conversations.
Yes, absolutely. And the middle part of my name, which is my maiden name, is Hughley, which when DL had his show, people could pronounce my name for a while. That was pretty awesome. And the last one, people will often say Noel, and is that with a K? And I'm like, okay, I give up. Nobody took phonics but me, I guess. Anyway, well, thank you very much. I'm the executive director at Portland Community Media in Portland, Oregon. And unlike Mike, I have been the ED for about a year, coming up in October. So it's been I've been on a pretty fast track, building on some of the improvements that had already occurred before I got there. But we've been on a very accelerated track to assess and implement a lot of provisions, a lot of program activity, a lot of kind of flexibility in the year that I've been the executive director. And most of it has been in response to sort of fiscal crisis and all, you know, the recession. And the rest of it has been in direct response to what our community tells us that they need. So let me see if I can figure out the technology here and go to the slide. Let me see if this is it. Yes, it is. First slide. Can you guys see that? It's kind of small type. So what I want to talk with you about, I'm going to answer the three overarching questions that are the basis of this particular session for you guys in our own unique way. PCM has indeed streamlined our staff and our facilities, and we've rearranged the physical layout of our facility to make it more open and community-oriented. So many of you guys had the tour a few years ago when you were up at a conference. It's changed a lot. It's less dark and movie theater-like as it was before. We have a multimedia lab that is sort of a cafe style that we've included in our lobby. So people walk in, they check out a laptop, they sit down at these round tables, fancy Lucite chairs, drink a cup of coffee, visit with each other, help each other on projects. A lot of spontaneous peer learning happens in that space now because it's set up in a way for people to really engage. So that's one of the changes we've made. And then the other thing that we did out of necessity as our staff began to shrink was that we used to be organized as sort of a P, small e, G. And we found that there's been a lot of demand by our communities and our nonprofit partners to really do a lot of specialized collaborations around education and learning. And we also found that, you know, we had to take a look at what is our mission. Our mission, and according to our largest contract with the City of Portland, is to make sure that we have a variety of local programming to fill our channels or we'll lose them. So we've got six channels, and everything that we do actually leads to that outcome of getting good content on our channels and by as many different voices as we can. And the way that we do that, of course, is by promoting our organization, helping them understand that, no, indeed, we are not the government agency that does it for free. It's kind of a big hurdle that we have to get around. But basically, we started looking at how do our stakeholders and users experience their interface with us. And so we started thinking about how do we cultivate and nurture them through the process of being completely, having an idea but completely confused about how do you use the technology in its various forms in order to get the outcome that they want that results in programming on our channels or on the internet. So we really started looking at that. We broke down the departmental walls between what we had set up with, you know, government video production services, education all by itself in the back room, and, you know, public access. And we developed this super operations team, which, because I'm silly, I generally refer to it as
super ops.
I swear I'm going to get a cape this year, just so my staff can, you know, really get it. Super ops. So we're in super ops, and within super ops, we cross-train all of the specialized and expert skills that we have on our staff to do production, to be instructors, to provide one-on-one technical support for our community producers when they come in the door, to, you know, answer the phones, to do a studio show, everything. Everybody gets cross-trained, and everybody's schedule gets, there's a lot of flexibility, and there's a lot of camaraderie. And morale has really soared because they get to go down to City Hall and work the robotic camera. They're all happy. They're all like, oh, God, they go to City Hall and work the program. You know, they're excited because, you know, they don't want to sit in playback anymore that day. And they get that opportunity to do that. So that has been a good thing, because what we're finding is that, of course, our community producers, our stakeholders, our participants who come in the door have well-skilled, well-trained, enthusiastic and passionate people that they interact with when they come in, regardless of what their kind of like job title is and what their role is. So that's been a really good thing for us. Of course, we'd like to have more people so that everybody doesn't feel overwhelmed, but, you know, we'll get there in time. Let me see if I can get to the next slide.
Excuse me, can you put that in slide mode so it's bigger?
Let me see if I can.
Did you have problems?
Is something wrong?
Oh, technical difficulty.
Just before we started, so.
Oh, okay.
Can you see it?
I'm taking notes. You're very good with it.
Okay.
Oh, that helps. Thank you.
Okay, good. So then the other question that was posed to the panelists was, should community media centers rent their facilities, you know, to other agents or whatever? And we've been grappling with this. We do have a rental policy. We've updated our pricing policy around how we utilize the facility. We recognize that we have, at certain points during the week, a lot of idle time in the building itself, and also for all of the equipment. You know, we get, the way that we're organized, of course, we, about 80%, maybe 70 now, of our funding comes directly from our city agreement, which has a long list of sort of vaguely described activities that we must, you know, do, and it's not really enough for us to really operate on. It doesn't really provide what we need. As we've, you know, as we've been experiencing the economic recession, of course, those dollars are essentially flat, and so, of course, it costs more, and that's that. And so we have to make up that difference. So we've been looking at a lot of ways that we diversify our funding stream, our resources. And one of them is in renting the facility, our edit suites. We haven't figured it all out yet because we've got some concerns, and I think our funders have some concerns. And so what I would suggest to you, and this is what we're grappling with, is, well, who are we renting these facilities to? If our primary objective, of course, is to provide equitable access to the equipment in order to promote our community to develop their stories and get them on our channels, and who are we renting them to? And if we decide that we're going to rent our facilities to other nonprofits or other producers, as long as they only produce non-commercial content that goes on our channels, does that muddy our mission, or is that okay? Is that something that we want to robustly market? So we're still trying to deal with that, but in the meantime, we were able to get a couple of agreements with some of the larger production houses in town. There are not that many studios in Portland, and they agreed that they would refer their people that couldn't afford them to us. We haven't really seen a whole lot of activity from that yet, but that was nice of them, since they could be snarky and competitive, but I think we're not a threat. I kind of really think we're not a threat. But it's one thing I think we really need to be having those conversations with our major funders about whether or not they think that doing these activities somehow takes away from our mission or muddies the agreement, the contractual agreement we have with them. And so we're still trying to figure out in what way we can get on the same page. So that's one of the things that we've been challenged with. We've had some independent producers use our studio lobby as a set for an independent film. But it's not a super robust activity. Until we get all of those issues straightened out, we aren't going to go full bore with marketing and promoting that particular service. But we are concerned with having idle assets. So the other question that was posed, let me try this again. What was the other question that was posed, Mike? I forget it now.
Should be seeking other funding.
Oh, talking about other funders, just what's going on with our funding. Well, of course, you know, this is the first year that we've been pretty successful in making that shift from all of our money comes from one government contract to really beginning to diversify the source of our funds through earned and contributed income. And we've been fairly successful. We do a lot of partnerships with government agencies that resulted last year in earning through those contracts in excess of $120,000, which was significant. We're not that big of a town. So that was good. And that's over and above the obligations that we have incorporated in our agreement just to cover City Hall, City Council meetings, gavel to gavel. So this would be for things like covering a pet project of the mayor, sustainability plan, traffic summit, whatever, those sorts of things that people are just glued to. But we're really glad to provide that service because, our government officials, they mind their P's and Q's. They're aware that their community is watching. It really is helpful to see how the sausage is made in terms of public policy, and I think that's really good. And then we've also been mostly successful in establishing really robust and long-term partnerships with other nonprofits, and that's mostly to provide training and instruction for either their clients or their staff or their participants in some way through a variety of programs. And last year we were able to realize over $21,000 from that source alone, not including the workshops that we normally conduct just for anybody to come in and take, video instruction and field production and Final Cut and that sort of thing. So that's over and above just the regular stream of workshops that we offer. And so we're at a point where about 30% of our operating income and our operating budget is a little bit north of $1.5 million this year. About 30% of that is coming from these earned and contributed income sources. So we've also been challenged by how do we incorporate a really good fundraising plan that really ties our mission to individual donors and helps them understand and support us, because we have to overcome the notion that most of our constituents in the city of Portland think that we are a government agency and that we get all the money that we need from the government and that we're supposed to provide our services for free, which of course you all know is not true. You cannot really do that. I mean, you can in certain circumstances, and if you get an individual grant program that is fully funded enough for you to be able to do that. But for the most part, we're in an environment where we're not getting fully funding from the government. So we have to overcome that public relations sort of nightmare that says, Yes, we are a nonprofit. And yes, we do a lot of work with government. But no, we are not fully funded by the government. We, because we are a private nonprofit. Please give. And so we are really engaging in that more deliberately in this coming year through, you know, events and just really doing a lot of promoting and marketing and not just assuming people will just kind of drop out of the sky and come to our facility. I think that's my last slide, isn't it? So a lot of what we've been focusing on, I just wanted to say that where we see ourselves going in terms of programming and in terms of being able to establish even more and different partnerships is in the area of broadband. We've had a really successful capital grant by which we were really exploring what we were exploring digital literacy. We were exploring distribution of content on the internet, and we have a pretty good basis for changing the interface with our community producers to be online and to really provide support and training in using these broadband tools on the internet as they emerge. We don't know what they're going to be yet, but we're kind of prepared to help people to understand how to fully utilize these tools. We've been doing it for a number, like 4 years now, and we really feel like we're really on the ready to kind of turn around and on the, I would call it the, I don't know, not a really cutting edge, but, you know, like, we don't have the resources to be on the leading edge, but we're on an edge. We're on the edge. I don't know what that is. And we're kind of ready to go. And our community is responding well to that. City of Portland just accepted their broadband strategic plan, and it has a number of initiatives described in that that would include digital literacy, which is what we've been already doing for a number of years. And we're really excited about the possibilities of partnering with new and different entities and getting an additional revenue stream from the city of Portland to do that. That's our plan. So I'll stop now and let Bob come on up. And then, you know, I know you're going to be doing question and answer after we finish with these.
Thanks, Steve. While Bob is getting his equipment ready, I think, Bob, your PowerPoint's on the desktop.
Okay.
While he's getting that ready, I just wanted to say thank you to the people from Richmond, California, who were kind enough to come in today and do our thing. Cease, we heard your comments about City Hall, so you won't be playing this.
No, we have a great relationship with City Hall, all of our electeds, and they would say, oh, great, honey.
And I wanted to acknowledge Mitzi Herrera, who's falling asleep in the third row here. Mitzi is, Mitzi is recently appointed to a new FCC panel, right? You are the Consumer Cities Consumer Representative?
It is the Consumer Advisory Committee, and they're going to focus primarily on broadband adoption, expanding technology services for people with disabilities, some media reform, universal service reform. One of the ones I can't remember.
Well, good. That's good for us because we finally have an in at the FCC again. That's what we need. All right. I don't know about you, but they're not people that really answer the phone all the time.
There we
congratulations.
Go.
Congratulations. Thank you.
All right. We got something going on here. How y'all doing?
Right. I didn't think it was going to be this many people. I'm kind of nervous.
Relax, you're among friends.
When I started off at DC TV, I was kind of 6'2 with an afro so you can see what public access is. I'm Bob Thomas. I've been in the communications business, corporate communications business for over 25 years, working for one of the Fortune 500 companies. Been a producer, produced national syndicated TV shows, local TV shows over the years. But what I'm more proud of is that I spent over 20 years in the nonprofit world. And I did that because I wanted to enhance my skills. And so I have a different approach about public access. And so I'm going to talk in a little different mode here compared to some of the traditional things. And some of them may be new ideas, some of them may not be. One thing I'm really proud of, before I came to Washington, D.C., I lived in Texas for 20 years. go Cowboys, but I was board chair. I was board chair of Dallas Community Television, and I learned a lot about community access in Dallas. DCTV, you didn't know, located in Washington, D.C., reach over 350,000 households. And we have Comcast, two channels of Comcast, two channels of RCN, Verizon Files, three channels.
Three so, providers, those guys in D.C. are spoiled, aren't they? Yeah. Well, money rolling in.
I don't know about all that, but okay. But I know my CEO, she gets it right. So today we're talking about supporting your programming by maximizing your facilities. And so my thing is, what are some of the new uses for your facilities, and I said buildings and services? So I got a different approach. It's a totally different approach. And as I go through some of these things, then I'll give you the results and why we package it, because it's a little different. We're going to talk about new programming formats. We're going to talk a little bit about redesigning training programs, which is critical. Partnerships with nonprofits. The use of technology. How do we use that to get what we want? And then have a few things in revenue model. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. So the first thing that we've done at DCTV when I got there, been over those 3 years, we changed to programming blocks. I understand that we're in the public access business, but you're a television station. And you can't put two-minute programs on, you can't put religious programs on this minute, sci-fi the next minute, and expect to hold an audience. Regardless of whether it's public access, people have habits in how they watch TV. So we asked our producers to give us 30-minute shows or half-hour shows, and we'll do shorts. But the thing is, we have blocks. So we talk about blocks. We have an entertainment block, a public affairs block, an international block, sports, health, and youth blocks. That's important because you know on Sunday now that football's on. You can stand in your kitchen, you hear tick, tick, tick. You know that's 60 minutes. You know the sound of ESPN. So what makes public access any different than a normal station? So you have to address that audience. You just can't put stuff on. And also we require individuals to give us quality programming. If I can't hear it, I can't see it, it can't air. The law doesn't say just because you're public access, we put anything on. So we do prime time. So our prime time is 7 to 11. We take the best of the best of all programmings in those blocks and we air those. It's very important because you're talking about a quality of programming. People got HD at home because you're public access, that means you can put anything on, it doesn't work. Because your goal is, or at least our goal is to get that voice out there, uncensored voice, and get it to the individuals that want to watch that programming. And if you can't hear it or you can't see it, then people are not going to watch it. It's that simple. We create insertion spots, and I don't know if this is going to work or not. Let me see. And insertion spots is that we work with the Office of Cable Television, and they allow us to give what we call promos for the station or for new programs coming up, and it can air on ESPN or whatever, but it's been a great tool that DCTV was not using. Within a 14-month period when I got the report, the commercial value of those insertion spots were $1.2 million. You have to use what you got to get what you want, as they say. And so that's very important because we drive people back to the website and we use these to tell you what's coming on, like you know, Desperate Housewives new season. We do the same thing. I don't know if it's going to work or not. No, it's not going to work. So we'll just move on.
You guys run Desperate Housewives?
No. Well, no, we don't. But we have a show called Anacostia, and it's the black Desperate Housewives.
It's up.
Oh, it is. Well, I got it on the desktop, I'll show you. But we use that. We promote their new season. That show was an internet show. And individual call, we promoted that like it was the biggest thing on earth. I have people come in the station, they can tell you the blocks that we have and what programming is on. Because you're creating interest. You know, when we start talking about dollars and support, you got to get people to watch. That's the number one thing. If they don't know what you're doing and how you're doing it, then why should they be interested? It's no different than anything else. So, but anyways, a good show. They have a female pimp. They have a gay drug dealer. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just crazy. But this guy on the internet, this show is so big and he got so many awards. So we run that. Let's talk about redesigning our training program. When I got to DCTV, the first thing I found is We always want to train people. People learn how to shoot and edit, but they don't know how to produce. If you can't produce, then you can't give me product that people want to watch. So we require all new people to come in and learn how to produce. And of course, it's the best class, but I teach it. But that's the basics about research, what are you doing, how you're doing it, and what it should look like. And then once you pass that, you can become certified in producing class, then you can take the field tech or the studio, the basic editing, or any of those things that you want to take. And then we have advanced classes. So we do that because we create a production company. So for example, I have 16 people, four groups in the producers class. And we always require the topics to be something positive or something about the district that will be positive. So it's not about we hate traffic lights and cameras. It's about homelessness and the solution. Or it's about things that you can do in D.C. So we break them up, they pitch it like you would normally do in a situation of a TV station or a 60-minute show. And then the field group goes out and shoot it. The edit people edit it. And the studio do a wraparound. We call that student exposure. It's our 60 Minutes 2020. And we get a host. So we teach everybody how to work as a team. They create teams, but you learn the business. Because my goal is to do what? To get quality programming. And so I want people to know how to do it, to give me quality programming. So you got to give them the tools and the knowledge. And then we have advanced classes and all these kind of workshops. And we're going to get to how this turns into all the other stuff. Then we have partnerships, the Center for Nonprofit Advancement. I don't know, there's 1,000, 2,000 nonprofits in D.C., I guess. And we work with the DCT Children's Youth and Trust. With the Nonprofit Advancement, Center for Nonprofit Advancement, we create modules, what I call modules, about what they call back office, fundraising, board development, things of that sort. Remember, the key word was modules, because we're going to get back to that. The key word is modules. And then with the D.C. Children's Youth, there are things about after-school programs. So I'm creating a market here because that organization has 2,000 nonprofits. I'm going after that. That's a revenue model, so remember that. Okay, and then the youth, they deal with all the educational type things within the city. So that's what, everybody knows them. They do great after school programs. So we're working with them to create those programs. We move forward. Technology. We upgraded the equipment, lighting, Final Cut. We use virtual sets. We took what they call the VT5, VT4. That's if any of you know about it, it's a portable studio. I spent $350 on some new software, and now people can do talking head shows that look like Access Hollywood. That's what we're talking about, quality. We teach them, we train them, they understand what quality is. Had one guy he called a real right side. He's funny because he's a black Republican in D.C. And he comes in and Obama this and Obama that. And it's great, love it. Because our job is to get the message out. So when we use the new set, and it looks like Action Hollywood, all of a sudden, everybody knows who this guy is. They're thinking he went to CNN. $200-some-odd investment. Some training. Now we changed that whole program. And I'll go back. The one thing I love about the insertion spots at, through Office of Cable Television, and we'll thank Eric Richardson and his team here for that, is that that goes to the DMV. It's the District, Maryland, and Virginia. So when you promote, everybody knows in those areas, that region, what's going on. So anyway, and now we're increasing our bandwidth from 1.5 to 50. And that's gonna happen in the next couple of weeks. So that changes our whole game now, because now we're moving to streaming. And remember, I talked about modules. I talked about training, I talked about quality programming. I'm going to do that video on demand. So when we go back to the partnerships, that streaming and that video on demand is going to be very important. So what are some of the results? Okay, we got significant improvement in the quality of our programs, and I'm going to try to show you a couple of those things, but we got great stuff on at night. Some sports shows, a youth block with children. They're producing shows for themselves. We have what we call New Faces in Cinema. That was something with African-American filmmakers, some of the stuff done on HBO and all that other stuff. How do we get them? Because we show them that our station has quality. And we created that whole block. So on Fridays, we would start with a tour of Farrakhan, which was a hot show. We go into New Faces of Cinema that deals with young girls without fathers, things of that sort. Then we go into the Tommy Taylor Show, which is a show that's based on Saturday Night Live. If you saw it, it's just as good as Saturday Night Live. And then you go into and to Anacostia. So that whole Friday lineup, we would get people just like that. People, if their show's not on, something's off the air, we get 150, 75 calls. So now we know we're doing the right thing. All right? Create positive competition with the producers. Everybody wants to be in prime time. When we first brought up the idea was, oh, that's not right. Some people are going to be upset. Everybody wants to be in prime time, and they want their show on those insertion spots because it'd be on Sunday nights, Anacostia, on Tuesday nights, this. Everybody wants that because their friends see it. Everybody wants to hear that. And so we talk about the regional stuff. Then we've trained over 236 adults and 57 youth within the last 10 months. Training has gone off the chain. We got people coming in from Virginia and from Baltimore. And the question is why? Because you can come into DCTV, you can get hands-on based on our training package, and you can learn TV for under $1,000 within a year. That's a whole new market. I mean, a lot of people are laid off and they got time and they want to learn some things. So it's great for the station. So it's working well. And then we do custom training programs for nonprofits, as we talked about earlier. You know, the things that we're doing. But then we have other people that come in that want to do what we call creative services. And that means that nonprofits want us to do this promo or do this. We've done all of the new stuff for the elections for the city. D.C., they came to us and want to talk to us about that. So we did that for 2 years ago. All the changing in the machines and the rules and all that kind of good stuff. And why? Because they're here and the word is on the street. So you can advertise all day, but when somebody tells you buy a Buick, your friend tell you that's what you're buying, a Buick. Okay? Because you can advertise all day, but word of mouth is the most powerful thing there is. Okay, so let's talk about a little bit, because I've tried to keep it to 10 minutes, that's what they told me, so. let's talk about those things that I just went through. So now we got programs submitted as local content for commercial use. So some of those quality programs we are now talking to NAB about using the program we have for local programming, because you know you got HD, but you still got your standard def, you still got those channels. Well, they have to, at some stage of the game, put local programming on there. And who falls in there? We do. So we're working that out right now, and we're going to be a test, a pilot on the local programming. So the quality is so good. So now, what is the revenue? What is the revenue stream that's going to come from that and the model? So that's yet to be determined. That could be a tremendous amount of money, and how you break that down with the members or the producers. So that's an interesting concept. We're about 70% there. We're securing underwriters for our program blocks, because now the blocks are hot. So now that the individuals with the shows in the prime time are getting underwriters, now we got people who want to underwrite the whole block. That's a different type of revenue. Hadn't thought about it, but because we go back to training and quality, viewership, now we get people, okay? Custom training is easy. The streaming is the best thing that ever happened to DCTV, because we're going to do what we call lunch in a brown bag. So what does that mean? Well, you got to set up a nonprofit advancement. So during middays, 12 to 3 or 4, we're going to deliver those modules via internet to the desktop for a fee to all their clients. Because nonprofits can't send people here to get trained, right? But they can pay $10, $15, $25, $30 at the desktop, and you right at work, you can see that you can get your training right there, and it's coming locally right from DCTV. Whole new revenue stream. Different train of thought. So when I say the modules, that's how we're gonna deliver those. And now we got the bandwidth, so it's real good. And then we'll do some video on demand with that also. Training has increased by 25% consistently for the last 2 years. We're just constantly, I don't talk about the numbers. The money is not what we're about. We're about individuals, and the bottom line is programs, because that's what we're about. Uncensored programs, the message for the community. Our creative services, doing things for nonprofits, have increased 45%. That's just cash money. It's cash money. And like I said earlier, the regional promos at value from the last report I got is $1.2 million. I'm sure once Maurice gets me the other numbers, because it's been a while, it's going to be higher. But it ain't even about the money. It's about the exposure. how we have gained an audience and got people really in tune into the public access court. Now, here's the most important thing, and I don't know if you can pass some of those around. I don't have enough. Added value. We did a market analysis. This is something I learned in corporate. And I looked at what was going on, what the cost is for studios, edit suite, field, what training costs, what staffing costs. And many of us in this paid business, we always talk about, well, it's good for the community. And the members, people in the community want to do this. But you know what? When you're on the other side, I'm a council person, and I've been chair, and I've been working with a lot of council people. The bottom line is, what is the value? You don't buy a house unless it's value. You don't buy a car unless it's value. So as a council person, you telling me it's a feel good. What is the value in this day and time? So what I do is what I call savings to the community. So everything we do, we educate not only the members, but we educate the council or whoever it may be. So if we spend, if it costs $5 to use a studio down the street for what we do, then I say we pay $1 and here's the difference. So I give you a cost on everything we do, what that value is and what the savings is to the community. It's very important because as a board chair in Dallas, they always went into the city council and you got people coming up and saying, okay, we know we love it, we support it. But the bottom line in these economic times, you got to tell me what the value is. And money speaks. Numbers always speak. And then we develop what we call a promo reel, like you do anything else. If you watch NBC some nights, they'll take a half hour and tell you what their programs are coming up for the fall. So what's the difference here? That's ourselves. So we put together those programs, and we make sure the city council knows, we make sure everybody in the community knows, we put it on our new website, we make sure everybody knows what we're doing, how we're doing it, when we're doing it, and then we make sure you know that you're getting a value for every dollar you spend here, you're getting $8 or $9 in savings. So you can't argue with that. So we do that from everything we do. We use a production software. Every time we put something in, I know what it costs for a staff person. I know we got contractors in there. Whatever we do, what that facility costs, I make sure that I know what that value is. So when you ask me what the deal is, here's what we say last year. I did that in corporate. We call it cost avoidance. When you work in a corporation and you're not out there making money, then you're not a profit center. So it's the first thing I did. What is the cost avoidance? So this year, people are going to say, I can go outside and get it cheaper. No, you can't. And here's why. Okay. So that's a different train of thought on what we do and how we do it. So I know I kind of went through that fast and we got any questions, but I was told 10 minutes. I'm sticking to my 10 minutes. That's my final answer. But that's a different train because my background is different. So I look at, I look at public access as a business. I look at it as a way to make sure that my job is to provide the knowledge and the tools for the members to get to make sure they produce their uncensored messages. But my job is to make sure distribution is there and people watch it. You can put it on all day, but if ain't nobody watching it, what's the point? And that's why in Dallas, they lost all the funding. When I left Dallas as chair, they had well over $450,000 in the bank. But they didn't show value. You had the same issues. They did the same thing every year with the council. They come up, you rally all the people, you get them there. It's simple. Show them value. Otherwise, they're going to take that money and do something else because every city is broke right now. So what is your value? So DCTV's value is what we save the city. It's the quality of programs, and it's the audience that watches those programs and want to know what's going on. Okay? So that's it for me. I'm going to try to get a little taller and get my hair back, but that's it.
Stand tall. I think you did a great job. I'm going to put this back here if anybody has any questions. I think we'd like to take some questions now. We have a few minutes for it. Okay, sorry for all the noise.
I'd like to know more about inserts from Mr. Thomas. I have this one already.
Oh, well, what those are is that the cable network provides the Office of Cable Television free commercial spots. And so they share those with DCTV. When I got there, we didn't use them. don't know why. But so what we do, we create promos for the station, health on DCTV Monday nights, of entertainment. And then we do promos for a specific show. It could be Anacostia, it could be whatever it is. It's got to be 30 seconds. You put a tag on the end. I send them over to the Office of Cable Television. They give them to whoever they give them to, a Comcast and RCN. The nice thing about that, we don't know where they're going to air, but they air in some hell of a five spots. It could be on ESPN. It could be CNN. It could be MTV. Home and Garden is a big one. So you don't know where those are airing, and they air all times, in prime time, in morning and evening. It's a great thing. We drive you back to our website or a specific time to watch a program. And it's free. It's absolutely free. Or it was part of the contract, I guess, the value.
It was negotiated.
Right, it's a negotiated
part of your cable franchise, yes, to get that in there and that it plays on other channels.
Right.
And it's usually done as an automated insert. So the cable company doesn't really pick where it goes. It just kind of has a computer that knows where you've got slots and runs in rotation.
And it has been the best thing for it. It's so wonderful.
And they usually do that on the channels where they have a local insert block, if I remember right. That's it.
Yeah.
Do I have one client or many? And from the city standpoint, does your PEG operation work for you exclusively? Or do you view them as working potentially for others?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
That's what I'm asking you.
I mean, I'm just kind of curious for the room here, because I would imagine that some people will treat that PEG operator specifically as almost like a city department or a sub-department, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a question there in terms of how then you do resource development. Really. Are you a city department or not? This is actually a specific legal issue in Minnesota because... can kind of roll her eyes about this when she had to deal with this issue in Minnesota. Many of the PEG nonprofits were actually created by municipal acts. And the question ends up being whether or not they are really truly independent nonprofits, 501c3s. And this caused a lot of focus for us about 5 or 6 years ago as the...
Stop speaking legalese.
Yeah. So, but I think, yeah, I guess, and I don't know what the answer is in the room in terms of, but
I've got one comment. I'm a cable administrator, but we have three pretty much separate entities under the PEG. We have the schools has three channels, our government has two channels. On that side of things, they very much see themselves as having one client. In fact, for the government channels, primarily the board, and doing presentations once a month on TV, and then a lot of their meetings, and then a lot of little spots that they do where they'll have a member who's talking about some initiative that they're particularly fond of, or they're driving, it's environment or it's education or something else. Schools, same way, they're very much focused on programs to help the teachers. There's some student participation in production and so forth, but it's not as much as it could be. And they have a substantial studio facilities which are not being used because right now we don't have a champion in that area in the school to lead programs that we want to show them. On the public side, they are very much into training, into doing the business,